President Trump is taking action against social media companies.
This executive order, which has been talked about for years and sort of picked back up in the last few weeks, would be the strongest, the most aggressive action that the administration has actually taken against these social media companies so far.
Plus, how coronavirus antibody tests are leaving some patients with more questions than answers.
She gets a positive antibody test and, you know, thinks, aha, I did have coronavirus. And then she, you know, takes another one and it's negative. And then you sort of end up in limbo. What does that mean?
It's Thursday, May 28th. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal. Here's what's news. New unemployment figures out today show 2.1 million Americans filing initial jobless claims last week. That's down from 2.4 million the week before, but still more than 10 times the level seen before the pandemic. Our labor and economics reporter Eric Morath says fewer workers are receiving jobless payments.
It fell by about 4 million from the prior week, and it's the first time it's declined since late February before economic fallout from the coronavirus pandemic started. So, you know, what that says is that Americans are coming off the rolls. They're going back to work. They're finding jobs or they're being called back by their employer. But the context is, you know, at above 20 million, the number of people receiving unemployment benefits now is still three times higher than the previous record high touched late in the last recession in 2009.
Separate data from the Commerce Department shows the U.S. gross domestic product falling by 5% in the first quarter. Economists expect a steeper decline in the second quarter. The House overwhelmingly approved a bill today that would loosen the requirements on small business loans under the Paycheck Protection Program. The measure lowers the threshold for how much businesses need to spend on payroll, from 75% down to 60%. It also gives borrowers more time to use the funding, up to 24 weeks, and it extends the deadline for rehiring workers until the end of December. The Senate has been working on a similar bill. The Justice Department says it's prioritizing an investigation into the death of Minneapolis resident George Floyd. The agency says it's looking into whether local police officers broke federal law while taking him into custody. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey called for peace in the city after 3 days of protests that have at times turned violent. In Facebook video that emerged earlier this week, Floyd, a black man, can be seen being pinned to the ground by a white officer who has his knee on Floyd's neck. Coming up after the break, we'll talk more about the president's action against social media companies. President Trump has signed an executive order that would limit the federal protections enjoyed by online platforms like Twitter and Facebook. The order comes after Twitter this week added a fact-checking notice to some of the president's tweets. Our reporter Rebecca Ballhaus says the tussle between the president and big social media companies has been brewing for a while.
The president, since the early days of his administration, has been vowing to take some kind of action against Twitter and other social media companies for what he says is a liberal bias against him and against his conservative allies. But until this week, he has yet to really follow through with any action. In 2018, he said that there was going to be an action coming soon to address what he said was censorship by social media platforms. In 2019, he hosted a social media summit at the White House where he invited some of his most provocative supporters to share grievances against large technology companies, but didn't announce any new measures there either. And earlier this month, he said that his administration was working to remedy what he called an illegal situation where the left was in, quote, total command and control of Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Google. But this executive order, which has been talked about for years and sort of picked back up in the last few weeks, would be the strongest, the most aggressive action that the administration has actually taken against these social media companies so far.
The order would make it easier for federal regulators to question online platforms when they suspend or delete users' accounts.
In terms of how this executive order would change the game for technology companies, it's important to note that the changes that are proposed in the order would be, first of all, would likely encounter quick court challenges, but also would be unlikely, even if they weren't held up in the courts, to actually take effect for months at the very least. What this executive order is trying to do is to clarify and strengthen the way that federal regulators interpret the current law. What they want to do is make it easier for federal regulators to hold companies like Twitter and Facebook liable for unfairly curbing users' speech. And they want to limit the broad legal protection that federal law currently provides those companies. But they're not proposing overhauling the law as it is, nor do they really have the right to do that. What they are trying to do is to direct the FCC to undertake a rulemaking process that would clarify the scope of this law. So that's something that will take, you know, months, if not years, to actually come about. And some experts say that the FCC actually has no legal authority to enforce the law as it is.
For more on this story, head to WSJ.com or the WSJ app. More Americans are getting antibody tests to see whether they've had an immune response to the coronavirus. Some are now convinced they may have had the virus as early as late fall. But there's no scientific proof the virus reached the U.S. before January. And antibody tests, while they show an immune response, are limited in what else they can tell us. Some have also been faulted for inaccuracies. As our reporter John Camp found out, that's leaving some people with more questions than answers. So, John, you spoke to several people who believed they may have had coronavirus earlier than it's currently believed to have even arrived in the United States. Tell us about what you heard from them.
Sure. Well, my colleagues and I spoke with some people who, they as far back as November, feel that they had just really severe symptoms that we now know are, you know, the kind of symptoms that you might have if you have coronavirus, you know, really difficulty breathing, you know, just really severe flu-like symptoms. Of course, it could also be something like the flu. You know, these are people who really felt like this was just extremely unusual. They were quite sick at the time. They were trying to figure out what it was. Then, of course, they learn about coronavirus and think that must have been that.
So tell us a little bit about why the timeline is so important here. Whether the coronavirus arrived here in January or perhaps late fall, what's the difference?
Well, as we learn more about the virus and as epidemiologists and scientists try and piece this together, the more information we have about, you know, how it moves from place to place, how it moves through communities, where it went and when, and who was affected, who died, who got sick. That's all part of, you know, the bigger puzzle that of course we'd like to piece together to really better understand the disease. For the individual people, there's also the, you know, potential peace of mind if they know that they already had it, and maybe that'll make them less inclined to have it in the future. And also a lot of them would like to become plasma donors to help other people who are struggling today. What we know about the timeline of when coronavirus got here and when it started to affect people is based on the evidence that we currently have from people who tested positive or people who died and who we believe to have had the disease. But that timeline is in no way set in stone. And a really good example of that was when a county in the Bay Area in California came out in April and said that they had actually gotten a laboratory confirmation of a woman who had died from COVID-19 in early February. And until that point, the earliest known deaths in the U.S. were in the Seattle area on the 26th of February. So just that one result completely reset the calendar by 20 days.
So we are hearing a lot about antibody tests now, but there are also some challenges that they present themselves as well. As you write, they sometimes can raise more questions than answers. Can you explain that?
Sure. The antibody tests, you know, they've certainly had some accuracy issues. The Food and Drug Administration has been trying to tighten standards to basically cut down on that. And, you know, there's another simple issue that even if they are accurate in terms of telling you if you did have an infection in the past, one challenge is that it doesn't tell you when. And so they just can't replace a test that you would have taken at the time for an actual infection. So they're not going to solve the calendar problem, and they really can't replace that test for an actual infection.
Is there a sense at this point that antibody tests may be providing a somewhat of a false sense of security? We're still not clear on whether the presence of antibodies necessarily indicates immunity from coronavirus, right?
Yeah, I think that is something that we're still trying to fully understand. And, you know, certainly, hopefully, it will lessen the odds. But of course, you have to have an accurate test in the first place. So, you know, there's sort of levels of security there, right? Number one, the test has to be accurate. And then number two, you have to know if that really confers some sort of permanent immunity from the virus in the future.
And you spoke to some people who actually got different results taking the test at different times, right?
That's right. Yeah, I spoke with a woman who lives in Virginia, and you know, she was really sick starting in January. You know, was just describing how it was just like difficult to climb the stairs. She was driving instead of walking for a short trip to the bus stop to get her kid to school. And this went on for, you know, several weeks, much longer than you would expect with, you know, a common respiratory infection. And then she gets a positive antibody test and, you know, thinks, aha, I did have coronavirus. And then she, you know, takes another one and it's negative. And then you sort of end up in limbo. What does that mean? So she actually recently took a third test and is awaiting results right now. So she may get a tiebreaker result sometime soon.
Certainly evidence to your point that it can raise more questions than answers in certain cases.
Right. And in her case, she would really like to donate plasma to help others. So being positive would mean that, you know, she has that opportunity to sort of, you know, use the benefit of being a survivor of coronavirus to help other people.
Wall Street Journal reporter John Camp. John, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
And finally, the coronavirus is giving a certain animal a bad name, bats. Some scientists have pointed to the winged creatures as the starting point of the outbreak. Others say there's no definitive proof that bats passed the virus onto humans. But as our Alastair MacDonald reports, that fear is putting many bat lovers on the defensive.
Bats attract an almost cultish devotion from those who like them, and they obviously are distraught, frustrated and horrified to see their favourite animal dragged through the mud in this way and nailed with this virus, which they think is completely unfair. And they sort of see the batlash on Twitter, other social media platforms, and actually experience it themselves. So, yeah, they are very much going to bat for bats, so to speak.
Of course, it's not the first time bats have been portrayed in a negative light.
Bats have always been connected with the darkness and devil and obviously vampires. And certainly from Europe, which is where I'm based now, in medieval times and medieval folklore, they were very much seen as being satanic. And then, of course, you had the vampire myths that came out of Eastern Europe and became famous through the writings of Bram Stoker in the Victorian times. So they've always had this sort of dark, devilish image.
Despite all that, bats still have plenty of fans. And that might be an indication that they'll weather the current batlash just fine. And that's what's news for this Thursday afternoon. We'll be back tomorrow morning. If you like our show, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.